the moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast, out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray, where the sea meets the moon-blanched land. Listen. You hear the grating roar of pebbles, which the waves draw back and fling at their return up the high strand. Begin and cease, and then again begin with tremulous cadence slow, and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles long ago heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. The sea is calm tonight, says Arnold, in the haunting and deceptively peaceful opening to the poem Dover Beach, with its evocation of a slow, melancholy sea, a full tide, and the channel brightly illuminated by the moon. It is one of these most English of poems, taking us to one of the many historic sites that helped define England as a nation. Dover has long held an important place in English lore, representing the place at which England so nearly joins the continent of Europe, but so often representing the place at which it most certainly does not. Accordingly, it is a location that is heavily fortified and steeped in a naval tradition and strategic significance that spans centuries. Arnold, in his description of the place, like some romantic poetry, delves into a symbolic range. It is hardly surprising, then, that the apparently peaceful first line soon dissolves and gives way to a disturbing vision of a world deprived of the romantic lyrical peace seemingly offered by his opening words. The reader is invited to experience the vision of the poet. Come to the window, the narrator urges his companion in the poem. But the invitation is extended toward the reader as well. Similarly, when the narrator says, listen, it is the reader audience that readies himself to hear the sensory description that follows. Ultimately, Arnold explores instead the kind of impending chaos and anarchy that he speaks of elsewhere in his work of social criticism, culture and anarchy. Arnold offers us a scene of strife and symbolic conflict at a beach where the sea meets the moon-blanched land, and where you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling. It becomes our task as readers to interpret the nature of the conflict that Arnold describes. On a denotative level, of course, it is a fundamental natural conflict of earth and water. On a connotative level, however, one must look elsewhere in the poem, and even in some of Arnold's other writing, for a sense of the range of meanings in the poem. On one level, of course, Arnold's poem takes advantage of Dover's symbolic significance and makes it a testing ground for the sovereignty of a nation. The public domain, the patriotic, is there in this poem, just as it would be in the Second World War anthem, White Cliffs of Dover. In the closing image of the darkling plain, where ignorant armies clash by night, the beach thus becomes a symbolic battleground for the Victorian audience, and a reminder perhaps of an aggressive foreign policy that was bloodily expanding the British Empire across the globe. Notice, however, that Arnold talks of ignorant armies, and perhaps there is a clue that the poem does not merely concern martial conflict, though presumably it is that as well, but cultural. The two are often inextricably linked, after all. Arnold, in his Culture and Anarchy, establishes some cornerstones in an extended argument suggesting that British culture was threatened by decline. Early on, he proposes a tendency towards Philistinism, arguing that the word culture is always used in a somewhat disapproving sense. With us, the word always conveys a certain notion of frivolous and unedifying activity. His own perception of culture is more exacting. He cites the definition of a French philosopher: the first motive ought to impel us to study, to augment the excellence of our nature. That passion for knowledge and improvement, which Arnold describes as scientific, should truly be matched with social aspirations for improvement, he goes on to suggest. It moves by the force not merely or primarily of the scientific passion for pure knowledge, but also of the moral and social passion for doing good. Collectively, he argues that, quote, the pursuit of perfection, then, is the pursuit of sweetness and light. He who works for sweetness and light works to make reason and the will of God prevail. He who works for machinery, he who works for hatred, works only for confusion. Culture looks beyond machinery. Culture hates hatred. Culture has one great passion, the passion for sweetness and light. It has one even yet greater, the passion for making them prevail. It is not satisfied till we all come to a perfect man. It knows that the sweetness and light of the few must be imperfect until the raw and unkindled masses of humanity are touched with sweetness and light. The same rhetoric can be found, only treated very ironically, in Conrad's short story, An Outpost of Progress, and in his novella with a related theme, Heart of Darkness. Arnold himself, while he cherishes such broad ideals, warns of the relentless drift away from the cherished sweetness and light and towards anarchy. The targets of his criticism are interesting, compelling even, perhaps for our own age, an over-reliance on the ubiquitous machine as an end in itself, and a celebration of liberty without responsibility. Arnold's social criticism, while it is not clearly delineated in Dover Beach, might be read as a backdrop to his poem. It provides a nexus of ideas that are alluded to in those sometimes ambiguous lines, in the manner that the reader may use ideas and be nourished and not bound by them. Perhaps it is this conflict that underlies at least part of an ageless clash of land and water in his poem Dover Beach. There is more, however. Stanza 3 begins with an image at once strikingly different and related. He describes how the sea of faith was once two at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. Arnold's vision voices the popular Victorian fear of religious belief in decline. That fear is substantiated by the religious census of 1851, the year in which Dover Beach was apparently written, which shows the decline of the church. On Census Sunday, just under 2/3 of all Englishmen did not attend any church at all. That decline in attendance coincides with increasingly liberal theology, which led fundamental attacks on core doctrinal beliefs and such notions of biblical inerrancy. For example, in Essays and Reviews, a controversial collection of essays by liberal theologians published in 1864, along with the competition of increasingly scientific and rational systems of believing, epitomized for us today by Darwin's theories. Arnold's vision of his England, with faith, the retreating tide, now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world, offers a blighted view of his age. These are damned times, he wrote. Everything is against one. The absence of great natures, the unavoidable contact with millions of small ones, our own selves and the sickening consciousness of our difficulties. Significantly, though, while the poem engages such broad public spheres, there are readings of it that remain private or personal. In the personal sphere of the poem, we are listening on one level to the anguished voice of inner conflict. Faith appears to be under siege in the poem. What is there to believe in any more? Cries the melancholy narrator, vulnerable and exposed on the naked shingles, and foreshadowing the existential crisis that characterizes much of the literature of the early modern period. But the poem is also, at its simplest, a love poem, urging a momentary union between the timeless traditional opposites, the land and the sea, two contrary lovers, each alone in the tumult and conflict of the broader world and their own passion. The sea that struggles and raves is the British Channel itself, flinging itself vainly against the land, an almost stock image in English literature that has a number of possible symbolic connotations. The most familiar example of it elsewhere is John of Gaunt's famous Sceptred Isle speech in Shakespeare's Richard II. But in Arnold's poem, it is more. It is also the sea of human misery that the ancients talk about, a culture at sea, caught in a relentless drift towards anarchy and away from sweetness and light, and the sea of faith, retreating from internal collapse and 19th-century scientific rationalism, a kind of existential crisis that threatens the state and the individual alone, here as on a darkling plain. It is also the sea of love, hence the desperate appeal towards the end of the poem, "Our love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain." What Arnold's poem suggests is that even in the fullness of the Victorian experience, there are seeds of crisis and doubt that prefigure the earlier 20th century collapse of empire. Those seeds flower in different ways, in different texts.